This is The Big Web Show. Everything web that matters. We talk about web publishing, art direction, content strategy, typography, and more. The show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman and Dan Benjamin. That's me. And this episode is brought to you by Zendesk, a leading provider of web-based help desk software that's reinventing how companies engage with their customers. Serving more than 5,000 businesses like Groupon, MSNBC, Twitter, and more, Zendesk products are easy to customize, integrate, and use so companies like you can quickly start offering better customer support. Use code 5x5 and you'll get 25% off your first 2 months at Zendesk.com and by Shopify.com, the internet's most elegant, customizable, and affordable hosted e-commerce platform. You can take advantage of their thriving theme and application community to add beauty and depth to your site, and you can use your own HTML and CSS. You don't have to use stuff they use. You create your own. No problem. Join at Shopify.com and use the code 5x5 there, and you'll get 3 months free. So we'd like to thank them. Thanks to MailChimp for sponsoring our bandwidth, and thanks to Wistia.com for hosting our videos. And finally, I can introduce and welcome back my my lovely co-host, Mr. Jeffrey Zeldman.
Oh, thank you, Dan. Thank you. Thank you for that. Let me thank you for that lovely introduction, as always. And let's get right to our guest today. It's the first episode of the new year. So happy new year, everybody. 2011 is going to be fantastic. And we're starting with usability expert is what we used to call people like Dana, and we'll let her decide what terms she's happiest with these days. But she's a UX designer, and she's working on a big project for the U.S. government to make elections make elections more usable. This isn't about who gets elected. We can't really do anything about that. It's just about how we choose, right? Or it's about the experience of choosing the people who get elected.
Right.
So exactly. What is that? When did you start doing that? And who hired you and all that good stuff? How are you doing that?
Well, I started working on usability in voting a long time ago. Not long after the election in 2000. When the Supreme Court appointed a president for the first time. And turns out that whole thing came from a design problem, but we can get to that later. So I started looking around for something local to do. Then I lived in San Francisco, and I found a committee for the city called the Ballot Simplification Committee, which doesn't actually simplify the ballot, but what it does do is it writes digest summaries of the measures that are going to be on the ballot that are unbiased and gender-free and all those things, and fits the description into about 300 or 400 words. And
description of the candidate?
Digests of measures that are on the ballot. In other places, they're called questions. So this is a way for voters to vote on legislation, basically.
Like, as an example, should we arrest people who are short or something? That would be a ballot initiative. Or should we make it illegal to have alcohol in our state? I mean, that kind of thing.
Right, yeah, that kind of thing. One of the wackiest things that happened in San Francisco County was a ballot initiative, a measure on the ballot, to change the name of the sewage treatment plant from, I don't know, the San Francisco Municipal Sewage Treatment Plant to the George W. Bush Water Treatment Center. But they're not all that frivolous. A lot of them are very meaningful. They have to do with how policemen get paid and how many firemen are on duty and things about park and recreation. They're often bond measures for the school district. And we have to boil all those things down to about 300 or 400 words. And it's always a big challenge. It happens in a committee, in a public hearing. It's like editing Iron Chef style.
Would you say that the way things are written influences, I mean, it seems like common sense, the way things are written could influence how people vote for them. There's the famous story of they asked the Pope, the previous Pope, if it was all right to smoke while praying, and he said, of course, it's always appropriate to talk to it was all right to pray while smoking. And he said, of course, it is always appropriate to reach out to God. And another time they asked the same Pope if it was okay to smoke while praying. And he said, no, when you're talking to God, you shouldn't allow earthly things to pleasures to distract you. So the same question, depending on how it's phrased, gets a different answer. I mean, it would seem that what you're doing is fraught with politics, because it would seem that there might be groups that want to write an initiative one way or another in hopes of getting a certain... Yeah, so how do you deal with that? So it seems like you're not just, as in all user experience projects, you're not just trying to create the ideal experience for the user, but you also have to manage a whole lot of decision makers and get them to buy off on a workable solution.
Yeah, it's really an interesting set of challenges, especially in that kind of very local situation. But it happens at the federal level as well.
Are you doing it at the federal level?
Political. But no, nobody's doing this at the federal level, but there are a lot of other things going on at the federal level. Like, I worked on a big research study with Jenny Reddish over a couple of years, looking at the language of instructions on ballots. And we had to be careful about what ballot we chose to use, what the names on the ballot were, what voting system we put the ballot on, who was in the sample of voters who were in our study, and what examples we took instructions from.
You go back a second. You said what names were on the ballot. Surely the people who are running for office, their names.
Well, when we did this study, it was sort of between elections, and we conducted the study in three different places. So to kind of level out the controls across the three different places. One was in Georgia, in Marietta, Georgia. One was in East Lansing, Michigan. And one was in Baltimore, Maryland. Because we wanted to get a mix of urban and rural and red and blue and all that stuff. We wanted to use the same candidate names on all the ballots across all the locations. So we used a ballot that was developed by the National Institute of Standards and Technology for testing voting systems, and so that has...
So they were fake names? Like
they were fake names, but...
It was an imaginary election?
Yeah, exactly. It was a mock election. And so they were fictional names, but they're realistic.
How do you motivate people to vote for fictional characters they've never heard of?
Well, first, you pay them an incentive for taking part in this study. But also, the way the study was constructed, we were focused on learning about how the instructions were worded. So what we were watching for was, could people follow the instructions to cast their ballot? And so we gave them a slate to vote from. So they didn't necessarily care about who they were voting for. And in voting studies, that often works fine. For the kind of thing that we're looking at. But we've also done, I've worked on studies on real ballots, and in those cases, you're looking for different things. So
This is a control. You wanted to see if people in rural areas had different problems than people in urban areas, or...
Right. Yeah, that was one of the things we were looking at, but we were also looking at education levels, because we had seen some other studies that showed that people from minority zip codes or zip codes where generally the education levels were lower made more mistakes on their ballots, meaning that they were less likely to vote in the way that they intended to vote. And we found exactly the same thing in our study with 45 people.
Do you get any, are there people who say to you, well, if people are too stupid to vote, then that's their problem?
Well, Alexander Hamilton said, the people is a great beast. There are a lot of very uninformed people out there. But the truth is that voting is a lot harder than any of us might think. I mean, I have very educated friends who are very stressed when they vote, even though they're very well informed. I mean, one guy I know has a master's degree in political science, and he described the experience of voting in the last election as very stressful because he was still afraid that he was not using the ballot the right way, that he was not interpreting the instructions the right way. And
I get scared with those machines in New York, although I think they're not going to use them anymore. Is that right?
Yeah, New York is not using the lever machines anymore. It's the last state to upgrade its voting systems after a law passed called the Help America Vote Act in 2004. And so, yeah, New York State had been using these mechanical lever machines right. for like 40 years, and people love them.
Did they?
So switching over has been an emotional battle as well.
I always felt scared, like I was going to pull the wrong lever and make a mistake. Yeah, they're totally from the 60s. I mean, they're totally like, they basically could film Mad Men at a New York election.
there's a great
handles
video.
For people who haven't experienced it, these giant handles that you put, I mean, it's all, yeah, they're like cartoonish.
Yeah, they really are. There's a great video on YouTube from the manufacturer of the biggest lever machine company about that was done in like 1962 or three. And it is, I mean, if you didn't know that it was made then, you'd think that it was something that the Mad Men series had made up. It's just beautiful. It is so much a thing of its period.
Wow. Yeah, I love that period. I was learning when I was a little kid, so it's amazing to me. I feel bad for kids now in a way because these times are so, don't seem as quaint, but of course they will.
Well, right, exactly.
Yeah, I've heard that's how it works. So who's responsible for conducting all these tests? Are you a nonprofit? Is it a client of yours? Or is it something you put together? And what results do you hope to achieve, or what results have you actually achieved? What we want to hear is, what have you learned? What extensible things have you learned that you could mm-hmm. share? And what results, what changes have you recommended or initiated? But first of all, who's behind it? So that's
who's
all my questions in advance.
You'll have to remind me of all of them as we go along. But who's behind it? There are a bunch of people behind it in very different areas. So one of the groups that I work with is the Usability Professionals Association Usability in Voting Project. The project was founded by Whitney Quisenberry many years ago, and there are a few, happy warriors who go around teaching counties and states how to do usability testing and good basic best practice guidelines for ballot design. And it's like 10 of us all together. And we've been doing this for a while in places like Kansas and California and Ohio and Minneapolis and Florida and New York. And we often work with a group in New York called the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. It's an advocacy group working on legislation, civil rights issues around voting and other areas. And there's a group with AIGA also called the Design for Democracy Project, which was spearheaded by Marsha Lawson, who's at the Design Institute in Chicago. And she first worked with Cook County many years ago on their ballots, wrote a beautiful book called Design for Democracy that a lot of elections officials use as sort of a high-level guideline about what works well and what doesn't in elections. But at the federal level, along with the Help America Vote Act, which gave money to every state to upgrade its voting systems, a commission was formed called the Election Assistance Commission, and it works with the National Institute of Standards and Technology to develop standards, which are voluntary, for voting system manufacturers to use in developing their systems. So huge, massive standards document, like 700 pages. There are now two versions of it that we stopped calling them by the years because that was that's too hard.
Yeah.
Now there's 1.0 and there's 2.0.
Is there a simplified? In my experience with standards, there's usually hundreds of pages of documentation that very few people understand. And the documentation's filled with disagreements and things that don't really match up. And then usually things are successful if there are a few very simple ideas, and you know, like Bert Bowe's ideas about what is good design, right? Right.
Yeah.
Her early ideas for the web about what was good design. Are there simple big ideas that you're getting from this, and not just for not just for ballot and election design, but for other kinds of design?
Well, you know, all of the research that's been done, all the testing that's been done on ballot design and voting system design lines up exactly right with all we know about interaction design and user interface design.
So, yeah, so in other words, voting should be done with blue underlined links.
Well, like things should be obviously clickable on electronic voting systems, right? You got a touch screen, and the way the voter casts the ballot is by, you know, putting a finger on the screen. It should be obvious that that is a thing that you put your finger on, and there's feedback immediately that has been selected.
Yeah. Did you ever see that wonderful? It's a Simpsons Halloween special, but it starts with voting.
Yeah.
And he casts his vote.
Yeah.
But he keeps
Homer
getting
casts his vote, and it keeps switching his vote. He does it
keeps switching his vote until the machine kills him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Since we're talking about other kinds of projects, when you're not doing, this is pro bono work, I assume, correct? You donate your time?
Some of it is pro bono work, but a lot of it's not. The research that I've done for the National Institute of Standards and Technology is paid. Your tax dollars have kept me alive the last couple of years, and I appreciate that. Thanks to all of you who pay your taxes.
That's cool, but... you're gonna have to recite the Constitution before you get your next check. It's the thing. So are you involved with like AIGA and the Winter House Institute and all that stuff, or are they all separate projects that are all kind of?
I am involved with AIGA mainly through the Design for Democracy project, but they all sort of intersect. It turns out that there are not a lot of people working in this area, and. We all end up in the same places at the same times for the most part. So part of my plea in going out and doing talks and going to events like doing the breakout ballot design studio at IDEA with Yoni Null was to recruit more people in the UX world to come work on this stuff. A lot of it is pro bono, but the cool thing is you can walk into your county offices, offer your services, and affect change, positive change, making voting easier for people very quickly. And
you
that
said,
is super important.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I just want to ask, you said UX world as opposed to design world. Is there a... it seems to me that there's a lot of that it's the same world and that there's a lot of overlap, but there's also, just like with design and development, there's it's the same, and yet there's also a rupture, and there can be. Have you been part of any of the politics of that, and do you find
to stay out of politics as much as possible? It doesn't look good for my voting resume.
There you go. Okay. Well, when you're not working on ballots and this project, what other projects do you work on? What other kinds of things do you do?
Oh, all kinds of crazy things. Commercial projects of various types. Usability studies and teaching of companies like insurance companies or banks, financial services, a little bit of healthcare here and there. A lot of what I do is
sexy. It's really hot. usability studies in healthcare, especially if forms are involved. That just sounds like so. Yeah. How does a UX person get a portfolio? I guess is my question, because UX is design. It's a form of design, right? But it's an aspect of design. All designers have to be involved in user experience, but some designers can, you know, at the end of the day, they can say, I made this, and it's just some beautiful page, some beautiful book, or some beautiful website. How do you have a portfolio if you can say, well, it's like the old joke about the director, the film director, right? And it's trying to explain to his child what he does. And so you wrote the story, Daddy? No, I don't know. The writer wrote the story. And well, then you, no, I'm not the actor and I'm not the, how do you present your work?
I don't really have a portfolio. I happen to be lucky enough to have worked on a book called The Handbook of Usability Testing with right. Jeff Rubin. And so people call me up because I worked on that book and they think that I know how to do a usability test. And fortunately, I've been lucky that they don't assume that that's the only thing I know how to do. But how does a UX person do a portfolio? I think portfolios in general are hard because if the design is good, it's almost invisible, right? I mean, a graphic designer, you can talk about visual hierarchy and type and color and things like that, but still, in a user interface, it's got to work. And so how do you demonstrate that to someone who's buying your services, who doesn't necessarily need what you've done exactly before? I think that's hard. I think you have to be good at communicating how you were involved in the project, what you did to inform the design decisions that were made, who was involved in making those decisions and how you worked together. But to show up with a little satchel full of images of things that you worked on. I mean, like, I don't have any links on my website to websites that I have worked on,
right?
Because
you do not.
They change all the time, you know? And so what would I be saying about that? I don't know.
You have links to your book, to your at usabilityworks.net. You have links to your books, to your talks, to places you're going to be, your blogs, other people's articles that you found insightful. That sort of thing. So it's more of an essay test. So if you're a designer who majored in English, if you're a designer who, you know, who's maybe people didn't gather around your comp and like want to kill you because you're so talented, but they really loved hearing you talk about your work. Maybe UX is a good field to get into. If you're listening to this broadcast and you're having kind of an indifferent success as a visual designer, but you're really interested in problems of how do people use things and that's it. What got you into usability testing? How did that happen? And how did you get into UX? How did that happen?
I was a technical writer. I was working for a think tank research firm in Washington, D.C. called American Institutes for Research. And within that was an institute called the Document Design Center. And I was writing manuals for IBM systems. And we were writing the first user-centered documentation. So it was task-based instead of system-based. So, for example, it had procedural steps instead of a description of the system. This was a really radical thing at the time. And
really?
To prove that it was going to work, IBM set up usability tests. And so we tested the documentation in a lab that they had in Irving, Texas. And so we brought people in and asked them to do things on the system following the instructions in the documentation that I wrote. And we could see there what was working and what wasn't, you know, where we had left out steps or descriptions or things that might help people be more successful. And so I was a data collector in that series of tests. And then we went on to doing other usability tests for other groups. So that's how I learned how to do it. And then it was practice from there.
Now, there's an article here on your blog where you talk about overcoming fear of moderating UX research sessions. And what's actually interesting to me in this article is you describe what it's like to be, and you use the term, you know, amateur moderator. But I think when people are starting out in the world of UX and they're running these kinds of tests, you have to think most people are not like you. Most people haven't written a book on this. Most people don't have years and years of experience, but they're still tasked with, you know, with creating a great user experience. So maybe this is something you can talk about, because we have a lot of designers in this audience. How can you as a designer go through, even if it's just with you and your spouse or your friend or your work colleague, how can you create your own sort of mini UX session where you can see if what it is that you're designing or building or working on is actually effective? Is there any tips or advice for that for people who are listening, saying, how do I do this? Because they probably don't have the benefit that that you have of your experience.
Nobody grows up saying the thing I want to do when I'm big is, you know, be a moderator for usability testing. It's a learned skill. Anybody can learn it. You just have to practice. And most people get better at it. Designers can do it. Developers can do it. I've seen all kinds of people do it. And sometimes being in that seat as the designer or developer or the product manager is really gives you lots of aha moments. It gives you a very different perspective. So I encourage everybody to go try it. So if you want to just get some very quick feedback to inform design decisions, doing this is actually really simple. The recipe is you need something to test out with someone, someplace that it actually makes sense. So, you know, with a ballot, we've done things like intercept people who were standing in line for something else at a county office and taking them off for 10 minutes to do this. I've had other people approach possible users in food courts at malls. You can walk down the hall in your company and get somebody who would normally do this thing to try it out. The key is that you want to see people actually interact with what you've created. So you can watch how they behave and hear their comments. Just sort of interviewing them doesn't give you the same kind of data to make decisions on that seeing the behavior, seeing the performance will give you. So,
your article was about not being afraid to give feedback, and just to connect all the dots. The idea being, I guess we all learned, you don't do a usability test by saying, no, hit the nav button, the one on the top left, that one. Because you're not going to be there doing that when the person's really using it.
Exactly. So, well, it's not a training.
Given that taboo against interfering, how do you give feedback to the user and yet not influence the results? I guess that was the...
Yeah.
Well, you give very little feedback. So a lot of people will, as your study participant, say, I'm going to try this now. Is that right? And you have to kind of echo back, whatever you feel like doing or whatever you think is the right thing to do. So you have to be neutral and observing and open, kind of zen in all those ways. But it is difficult for some people, especially when you're first starting out, to not just give the answer or to train the person. So holding back, one of the tricks that I have learned is just to wait. Sometimes people will ask you a question like that, and if you just don't say anything, they'll go, oh, you're not going to tell me, and they'll try something.
It almost seems, Dana, to me, like it would be easier to focus on the usability of user experience of something that you weren't responsible for designing or for building yourself. In other words, because I've been in that situation where I've built an app or I've built a user interface, and you're sitting there, you've built this thing, and you're watching the person maybe struggle with something, and you want to say to, no, just this is how I made it work. I mean, is that something that you found to be true?
For me, I personally, I'm rarely involved in the design. It happens every now and then that I'm brought in at the beginning, and I stay with a team all the way through to launch and maybe after, with lots of iterations in between. But usually companies bring me in because there's some problem and there's trouble and they need someone objective. Now, I've worked with plenty of teams, though, where I teach everybody on the team, the designers, the developers, the product managers, the CFO, how to do user research and usability testing, and then they all go do it on their own. Some people are really good at abstracting themselves and sort of standing back and taking in objectively what they're hearing and seeing from users as people interact with the thing that they've designed, and other people are not. And learning that is a useful thing. So that probably means that you shouldn't be moderating usability test sessions or going to do user research.
Right. I was going to say, it almost seems like a job for a gentle, quiet soul who's almost like a therapist, like the qualities that might make a person a good therapist.
I do often find myself saying, how do you feel about that?
I think it's going to be tough, though, for people, because in many cases, and we know this from having other UX people on this show and other people that we've talked to, it very often the designer is also the UX person or vice versa, and they are very often heavily invested in the current design, the current implementation, the current process, and yet they're also tasked with determining, is this actually any good, this thing that we've been building for 6 months that we can finally now put in front of somebody. I mean, what kind of advice do you have for those people, other than just being quiet when that's something difficult? Well, is that really
should they test early, like with paper prototypes or something like that?
Right.
Absolutely. Test early and often. And the thing with prototypes is you have to be willing to throw it away, right? You have to not feel ownership of that design. You have to be able to walk away from whatever you found.
I have one quick question for you.
Yes.
It's my subjective impression that there are more men in design and more women in user experience. I could be totally smoking crack. I don't know. But is that your impression as well? And if so, what do you think accounts for it?
No, I don't think that's necessarily true. Maybe you just meet a lot of guys who are in design. I meet a lot of women who are in design. And
so I'd like to meet a lot of women who are in design.
Well, we can talk about that later.
Right.
But I do believe that there are things that women are better at and men are better at. Would I be able to separate those things out in user experience design? No, probably not. But I think there are pockets of UX that are populated with more women or more men. And I think that, from my experience, is about where those people came from and sort of where the practice is now. So, like, a lot of people who do usability testing as their main thing came from other disciplines like technical communication. And a lot of technical communicators are women because you're writers. Now, that wasn't always true. Before the advent of cheap personal computers, technical writers were guys because they came out of the military. So I think it's just, from my perspective, cyclical and maybe about perception more than anything else.
It's about perception, but also about history and the history of technology, just as you've just said. That was kind of what I was wondering about, and I think that was a brilliant answer. Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
I remember when I was young and technical writers were men. I totally remember pipe smoking, scotch drinking men. Like,
those were the days.
Yeah. Well, who remembers really?
So, Dana, if people would like to follow you or learn more about you, we have your Twitter name up there, Danachis on Twitter. But where are some other places people can go to?
Danachis.
Yeah. I like that pronunciation.
I like that.
Is it, what do you say, Dana Chiz? When you when you tell me I'm Dana Chiz.
Yeah.
So where else can they go besides Dana Chiz or Danachis?
They can go to usabilityworks.net.
They could. Usabilityworks.net. They can find out about her book there, which is linkable from that site. And they can also follow her on her blog, which is I think it's, is it usability? What's the URL?
Usabilitytestinghowto.blogspot.com.
There you go.
Usabilitytestinghowto.blogspot.com has broken like the first. No, usabilitytestinghowto.blogspot.com is not your blog?
It is my blog, but I thought you said that, I thought you said it, the blog was broken.
No,
but
the blog.
So I was thinking, it's such a musical name, and when we think of Cat Stevens, like, has broken only.
The whole broken thing, my most recent blog post there is about how usability testing is broken.
Yeah.
So that's what we should talk about next time.
Yes.
Okay.
So thanks very much, Jeffrey. Thank you very much, Dana, for joining us today. Sorry we had so many. For those who are just listening to the audio version of this, you're spared the multiple dropped calls and disconnects that we had throughout this. But for those who are here for the video, sorry about that. Dana, thank you so much for joining us and dealing with the lovely Skype that drops our calls so much. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Absolutely.
It was fun.
Absolutely.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. And you can check out, 5x5.tv to see previous episodes of this show and all the other shows that we produce. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Zendesk.com and Shopify.com. And thanks to all of you for joining us today. And we will see you all again, same time, same place next week.